Jesus Christ moves of the kingdom and curing every disease and every sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to the disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, I ask the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Then Jesus summoned the 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to cure every disease and every sickness. These are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, also known as Peter, and his brother Andrew. James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions: go nowhere among the Gentiles, and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. As you go, proclaim the good news. The kingdom of heaven is near. Cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. You received without payment. Give without payment. The Gospel of our Lord.
Jesus says, cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons, go. No big deal, right? We will come back to that, because it's there's a helpful way to understand all that. But first, just some background, because today begins in the church's liturgical year what I mentioned earlier about ordinary time, and so and it runs from now until the end of November, when we switch gears, another new year, first Sunday of Advent, off we go into a whole new deal. And so this summer we're going to be hearing some, maybe not consistently, but some serial readings out of some of the Hebrew scriptures, the book of Genesis and Exodus. Over the course of the summer we'll hear serial readings-ish from Paul's letter to the people of Rome, and then mostly some serial readings from the Gospel according to Matthew, because it is year A, Matthew's year. So we get to spend some time with this particular gospel and this particular ancient community. So some background is in order. First of all, Tracy. That was a perfect reading of that passage from the 18th chapter of Genesis. I mean, that was just the way you ended it was perfect. Oh, yes, you did laugh. I mean, and, you know, Sarah's afraid because the light's going on. Abraham is totally clueless at this point in the story. He doesn't know who he's talking to. He's just busy running around just trying to welcome them and be hospitable. I mean, there's a whole sermon in that, which we're not going to hear about today. And Sarah, being the smart one in the family, she's hiding out in the tent, helping out behind the scenes, and she hears this conversation with the three strangers, but one stranger kind of steps up and starts having this conversation with Abraham, and at one point says, "You and Sarah are going to make some babies." And Sarah's in the tent laughing because they're old. They're old people, right? And she laughs. The stranger hears it, says, "Why were you laughing?" And again, not giving Sarah a hard time, messing with her. So she's a little afraid. She starts figuring out what the deal is here. I mean,
one of these guys is God, right?
And she says, oh, no, I didn't laugh. Oh, yes, you did, says the stranger. And then it goes on, and there's wonderful humor embedded in the story, in a lot of these stories, in the early books of the Hebrew Scriptures that we miss when translated into English. So, Tracy, that was perfect. And we begin to catch, if you continue reading the story, you begin to catch both the humor and the irony embedded in the story, because sure enough, she gets pregnant and has this baby, and the baby is named Isaac, which means she laughed. Okay. It's a great story. And there's something about the cadence of it, too. For some reason, I started flashing on an old children's book I would read with my kids over the years, P.D. Eastman's Go, Dog, Go. How many of you folks are familiar with this book? If you aren't, this week's homework from church is read Go, Dog, Go by P.D. Eastman. It's just a hoot. You know, black dogs and white dogs, big dogs and little dogs. Where are the dogs going? To the tree, to the tree. There's just something. Go read the book. You'll get it. And again, one of the sub-themes, if you will, out of the book of Genesis is the whole question of hospitality. How is it exercised? How is it extended? And to whom? And not just hospitality in terms of, you know, food, like in this story, shelter, clothing, talking about refugee families, but also hospitality and openness to the Word. That's another theme. And again, there's a whole lot of fun that takes place in the book of Genesis around that particular theme. So, a little background there, and then we come to the gospel according to Matthew. This is Matthew's year. Let's just dispel the rumors right now. There was no dude named Matthew. He didn't run around to Palestine with a GoPro plastered to his forehead, you know, taping Jesus and then sitting down later and recording it. That never happened with any of the gospel stories. This is some at least three, maybe four or more generations removed, end of the first century of the Common Era. These people, we think, many scholars think that the community that received this version of the gospel tradition was somewhere in Syria, maybe Antioch, and up in the north where, you know, life is just exploding at this point. And so someone in this ancient community, having received these stories, decided to write them down with a set of ideas in mind. I mean, please know that every one of the Gospels has its own particular agenda. They all do. And the question is, can we dig deep enough to get a sense of what that ancient agenda might have been? And I'm about to help you with that this morning. So, this is Matthew's Gospel, the community of Matthew, is the preeminent Jewish story of Jesus. And there are all kinds of clues as to the nature of that. In particular, the way Jesus is portrayed throughout the gospel according to Matthew, he starts looking a whole lot like Moses. Again, very particular agenda going on there. And smattered throughout the gospel according to Matthew is all this teaching stuff about how the followers of Jesus can get along, which is very Jewish. You don't find as much of that in the other gospel stories as you do in Matthew. Because, again, end of the first century of the Common Era, this entire community has witnessed the destruction of Jerusalem and the burning down of the temple to the ground. And all around the Palestine, Imperial Rome is imposing its version of peace by destroying people's villages, towns, fields, crops, livelihoods, families, cities, and ultimately the temple in Jerusalem. I mean, you don't mess with Rome. And of course, we know how imperial powers work in the world. I mean, Rome may have invented a couple of things, but imperial powers have been around for a long, long time and continue on the planet. Rome, for instance, invented the lovely art of crucifixion, probably one of the worst tortures invented by humankind, and they also invented the approach of dividing and conquering. I mean, if you want to conquer, you know, some geographic area, get the locals fighting amongst themselves, and as long as they're focused on fighting each other, the imperial power is good to go, can do whatever it wants. And so that's precisely what's going on in the Palestine at the end of the first century of the Common Era. Jerusalem had been burned to the ground. The temple had been razed right about the year 65 of that century. And so this community of Matthew is looking back on that. And Imperial Rome has also ramped up their pogroms against the followers of Jesus and Jewish people. And so they're being hunted, they're being persecuted, they're being crucified by the tens of thousands while their towns, their villages, their homes, their fields, their crops, their families are being destroyed, because that's how you establish peace, right? Okay, so here we go. And Jewish people just aren't buying it. I mean, this is not a peace that they want to participate in. So the response just makes things worse, and then guys like Jesus are running around, and I mean, he's deeply aware, because he's Jewish, of what's going on with Imperial Rome and his people, his own family, but he is singularly focused on this idea of an alternate kingdom. And he calls it, in one gospel, the kingdom of God. In the gospel according to Matthew, he refers to it as the kingdom of heaven. And we've talked about this. Does anybody remember why that difference exists? Anybody? Remember what I said about this being the Jewish gospel? What's the one thing in public Jews couldn't do? Yep, use the name God. And so this author, being and this community, being the good Jewish folks that they are, they substitute the kingdom, or maybe better translation, the realm of God, for the realm of heaven. Now, please do not make the mistake of assuming that Jesus is talking about where we go when we die, and if we were good boys and girls, or if we flew under the radar and no one, you know, noticed what we're doing, that when we die, we're going to go to heaven. That is not what he's talking about. He's talking about an alternate kingdom, a realm of God on earth in real time, now. And so when he says the kingdom of heaven has come near, hot on the heels of that is the admonition and the invitation: cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. Now, the only way, from my vantage point, to understand this invitation and this challenge is to remember the setting in which this gospel was written. War zone, okay? Lives, families, cities, villages, towns, crops, fields, destroyed. the holy city of Jerusalem burned to the ground, the temple gone, Jewish people, not just in and around the Palestine, but all over the world, are scrambling desperately to try to figure out how to remain Jews without the holy city and the temple. They're scrambling. And then add on to it this layer of Jewish folks who have attached themselves and been captured by the message of Jesus, who are saying, well, can't we just like hang out in the synagogues and stuff? I mean, come on, just cut us a little break here. And everybody is on the ropes. So it's vital that we remember the setting of the story. And then when we get to this invitation to cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, and cast out demons. All of these are categories of what I would call restoration. In other words, Jesus is inviting his friends to go out and about in the communities that have been destroyed or are being destroyed, and communities that are being hunted like dogs to be tortured and put to death by Imperial Rome, and looking for all kinds of creative ways to restore them to a sense of community, which Imperial Rome is hell-bent on destroying. Are you with me so far? So to go out and cure, raise, cleanse, and cast out is to restore people to a wider sense of connection and belonging in order to be reminded that even in the midst of this unbelievable hell, that God is still with us, that the Lord is present against all observation. I mean, against all the evidence, God is with us still. Now, the whole raising the dead thing. We need to talk about this because it'll set the stage for the rest of the gospel according to Matthew, and it would be really helpful for us to understand how they thought of it in the first century and in the early centuries. There was this concept known as the general resurrection, and it was directed particularly toward those who had lost their lives, tens of thousands of people who had lost their lives at the hands of Imperial Rome. And the general resurrection was not based on the idea of a resuscitated corpse. It had nothing to do with dragging dead bodies out of catacombs or caskets or places where they were buried. Nothing. Neither, oh, by the way, did Jesus' resurrection have to do with a resuscitated corpse either. I know you're all freaking out right about now. But there it is. He was not a resuscitated corpse. He was the presence of God in the world. There's a difference. So, since we're not talking about resuscitated corpses, what exactly is going on here? And here was the notion of the general resurrection in the first couple of centuries of the Common Era. Again, Imperial Rome is bent on destroying these people in order to establish Rome's version of peace. And with all the lives lost and Rome intent on destroying the community, the general resurrection was the idea that with the presence of God remaining in our midst, that even the dead would be restored to the community. They're still dead, but they are restored to the community. I know this is hard. I know this is a tough one. Pardon me? Just watch TV. Yeah. Yeah. It's The Walking Dead or whatever. Yeah, no. No, no. That's not what we're talking about here. Yeah, Zombie Nation or something. Yeah. Pardon me? What do you mean, what would they do? What about Lazarus? Well, Lazarus is a different gospel story. That's in the Gospel according to John. Yeah. Here again, this is me you're dealing with. I mean, I don't mix and match gospel traditions, okay? You know I'm a stickler about this. So we can talk about the Gospel according to John, but that's a whole different conversation. If we stay with the Gospel according to Matthew and this notion of the general resurrection, it's kind of like the analogy I can offer you is in Latin America and South America when they celebrate Dia de los Muertos, where they gather in the cemeteries and they share meals with the dead, as if the dead are still with them. Tens of thousands of Jews are being crucified by Imperial Rome. They're probably being thrown in mass graves. I mean, if the families, you know, couldn't keep up with them while they're living under siege. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a disaster that's unfolding in the Palestine at this time. And so the people, they're clinging desperately to this idea, okay, if God is still with us, then we're all still together. Because if you remember the ancient promise that God issues to Abraham and Sarah, what's the promise? You're going to have your people and you're going to have a place, right? And if you lose either one, what do you got? Nothing. And so they're clinging desperately to this. And the general resurrection was, okay, all our, you know, two-thirds of our relatives are dead, but we're all still in this together. And commemorating that in some way. It's taking that idea of, however you pronounce it, Sheol in the Hebrew, the ancient tradition, and sort of ramping it up to the next level. Again, it's still not close to what you and I trip out about heaven or hell or anything, but it's the next step beyond that. Remaining in relationship. Okay? And so all of this invitation that Jesus issues to cure, raise, cleanse, and cast out is all by way of saying, y'all, followers of Jesus, are empowered to restore people to the community. And by the grace of God and in the Spirit, followers of Jesus can do precisely that. Well, there's a couple of simple ways that we do it here. It'll be different parishes, different traditions have different ways of embodying that. For instance, when somebody dies, like Diana Weaver died last night over at Sierra Place, we hold them in prayer. We, you know, if they've been on the prayer list in one place, we switch them to another place, and we pray for them for a length of time, usually about 4 Sundays, as though we're still in relationship with them. Our DNA has been altered by the Middle Ages, unfortunately, and especially when Christianity became the religion of Imperial Rome and then began to take on all the trappings of Imperial Rome and became the ruling power, the entire gospel tradition became distorted and was distorted, distorted, distorted until we end up with this thing now in the 20th and heading into the 21st century of this whole focus on shame, guilt, fear, heaven, hell, God's out to get you, we're in, you're out, and, you know, and it's a complete distortion of the gospel tradition. Total distortion. But the problem is it's embedded in our DNA, and it's like going through a blood transfusion. I mean, our blood has to be completely recirculated before we can begin to grasp what's really going on in the gospel. So I'm giving it to you full on, choke on it all you need to, but stay in the room with us. I mean, this is hard stuff, but it's really important if we're going to come to grips with the nature of the gospel and the invitation of Jesus, how we're supposed to live. So again, in some ways, this is very natural. I mean, it's so natural that we think that our religious tradition is actually trying to tell us something else, when in fact it isn't. We remain in relationship with those we love and see no longer. If the invitation is to imagine a world where those who have lost their lives are restored to the community, let's talk about what that would look like now. Here in Carson City, you know, in the West, in the United States, in the 21st century. So, imagine that the invitation that Jesus is issuing to us now is to see a world where everyone has a place, where everyone belongs, where everyone's needs are met, from the simplest, most basic needs to the higher spiritual needs, where everyone has a chance to live a productive and meaningful life, where everyone is restored to the community. And then hear the words, "The kingdom of heaven has come near." So, it's why we support Fish. You know, Fish helps people regain their lives when their lives have been destroyed for one reason or another. It's why we support advocates to end domestic violence, you know, women who have been abused, and Advocates now helps restore them to their own lives and to the rest of the community. It's why we support Circles of Support, because we're helping families who have been crushed by generational poverty regain their lives in all kinds of ways and be restored to the wider community. It's why we resettle refugee families. And in all that activity, you and I are participating in the kingdom of heaven coming near. So, little intro to the gospel according to Matthew. There's more where that came from, I can guarantee you. Keep your seatbelts on and give yourself permission to not get too, I mean, yeah, ask the questions, but don't get too distracted by the details. For instance, one of the things that's embedded in this passage is the naming of 12 disciples, right? And I guarantee you, if you went to the other stories to try to match the names, they wouldn't. The same in the ancient Hebrew tradition. If you try to line up the 12 tribes of Israel, there are like 20 different lists of who the 12 tribes were comprised of, and they don't, and none of them match up. And the clue is that the ancient ones didn't care about the details. You know, if somebody was really smart, some really smart rabbi would have gone back into the Jewish scriptures and cleaned up all those lists to make them match, right? And they didn't, because they didn't care. But the number 12, that number of completion, or what I like to think of as restoration, the symbol of restoration, of being reconnected to the community, that's what was important for them. And that's why we're having the conversation we're having today. So, the kingdom of heaven is coming near, baby. Keep your seatbelts fastened. Take a nice deep breath.